Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Ned Randolph, and I'm a visiting scholar at Tulane University in New Orleans and an adjunct there teaching when I teach environmental communication and writing. And I also do consulting work for environmental nonprofits in Louisiana.
Well, Ned, thanks a lot for doing this. It's nice to catch up because we haven't been together since probably the summer of 2022, I think would have been the last time we had a cup of tea together.
That's right. And
So
Tulane.
nice to see you. And we've just had a little gossip, preliminary gossip before recording. And
Yeah,
I wanted to
good.
begin, as I generally do, by asking what's currently dynamizing, informing, preoccupying, interesting you. What's happening for you?
Well, we have a, I would say it's political, and I would say it's in with it's state level rather than the worries about the a Trump Biden rematch, which of course is everybody's concern here. But we have a very conservative Trumpian governor who has staffed his environmental regulatory agencies with oil and gas lobbyists, and that has put a lot of even more pressure in what is a very petro-friendly state on environmental activism and environmental justice efforts. And so that is really the preoccupation with most of us in this space now.
God, I'll bet, Ned. And for people's background, you say petro-friendly, and I guess it's also a petrochemical disaster, isn't it? So much of the state in the Gulf in particular, but not just the Gulf, no?
Yeah, I mean, it's a petro state, but we are in a the Gulf is very intensively drilled for oil and gas, and Louisiana has a great deal of gas fracking, which supplies liquid natural gas terminals, which primarily export, and Louisiana supplies more than half of the nation's LNG that goes overseas. And Louisiana also has a huge petrochemical corridor along the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and even south of New Orleans, and is, despite efforts by people that are being sort of squeezed in between these giant petrochemical plants. I mean, they're doing everything they can to sort of bring popular attention to it, mustering legal action, appealing to federal authorities. And another thing I've been thinking about and interested in is how they kind of find hope in a time like this, and how the rest of us can really help bring support to them and really learn from them, because this isn't shouldn't be an individual effort. And they are up against very entrenched interests, and the state enthusiastically attracts these giant companies, industrial facilities, and while also exempting them from paying local property taxes, and really resists any effort to enforce air emissions, doesn't want to know, doesn't have much interest in setting up air monitors. And when people counter with these, a real spectrum of respiratory complaints and illnesses, they point to an outdated tumor registry as evidence that these are safe areas. So that's kind of what folks are up against. And it's actually going to increase rather than decrease in this sort of age of climate action, because the state is positioned itself to be the capital of industrial carbon capture and use. And so that means not only new facilities that new hydrogen facilities that are predicated on using natural gas to produce this hydrogen molecule, and then trying to capture the carbon from it, build new specialized pipelines to send that carbon to newly dug carbon capture wells to store it in perpetuity, or perhaps reuse it for enhanced oil recovery, all of which are heavily subsidized by the federal government. So the state just was awarded primacy for this regulatory regime of these new carbon capture wells from the EPA. And it's really hard for the state to turn down federal money. And so economic boosters up and down, the from I-10 to I-49 to I-20, which are these highways that crisscross Louisiana, are petitioning for new investments, that much of which would be subsidized by federal taxpayers. So it's hard to turn down other people's money. And if you can sort of greenwash this, not to you, Toby, if you can greenwash this by calling it low emissions or low carbon, or it's or clean energy, which it isn't, all the better.
The EPA, which Dr. Randolph just mentioned, stands for Environmental Protection Agency, which was the creation of the Nixon administration. It was a Republican creature, but has been gutted in lots of ways by successive administrations. And if Trump and his cohort get into power, I assume if they have majorities in both houses, they'll disestablish it.
That is the fear, and that should really galvanize everybody to do everything they can to support the current administration, to hold the line against what might be coming, what the alternative is, and it's not a good alternative. And their current EPA administrator, for all the shortcomings, the Biden administration, which, to its credit, passed this Inflation Reduction Act, which awards, sets aside a great deal of money for renewable pilot project investment for wind and solar. It also was heavily influenced by the oil lobby to support this industrial carbon capture. But Michael Reagan has been to Louisiana multiple times, and they've introduced methane reduction rules. They've introduced other particulate matter rules. They've really tried to bring attention to environmental justice for fence-lined communities. So it's not perfect, but it is attention that some of these issues are getting that for the first time.
And in terms of drawing attention to these issues, you've just had published by the University of California Press, Ned, a terrific new book, really great. And I'm hoping we can give a plug to Muddy Thinking in the Mississippi Delta, which obviously addresses in longer form some of the things you've just touched on. I wonder if you could adumbrate for us a little bit what the book's about and why everybody should buy it now.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I'm very excited this is to have this book published with University of California Press. It's a history of environmental and social justice in Louisiana. And it's really a genealogy of mud. As a cultural studies and communication scholar, I wanted to provide a history of the present, right? about why it was that Louisiana is on the front lines of climate change. It is the fastest eroding, has the fastest erosion rate in the country and perhaps world because of its subsiding and sinking marshlands, much of which were caused by this confluence of factors of oil and gas drilling and dredging and levying the Mississippi River. And so, and yet at the same time, it continues to promote this idea of what it calls a working coast and funds its restoration projects with oil and gas royalties, which sort of turns coastal restoration authorities into oil and gas enthusiasts. And so I kind of set about to sort of figure out how this sort of strange arrangement was, and how this idea of the working coast became common sense. And you know, as a communication scholar, I was we're sort of trained to think about common sense as something that's not a priori, but actually something that's historically developed and very much contingent on the way power relations sort of intersect. And so I started, and so I with this idea, you know, this it's a very com it's a sweeping history, I would say, of social relations and the environmental treat, you know, the political economy of the southern Louisiana area. And the through line for me was this idea of mud and how mud was this foil to capitalist extraction. And whether we were talking about dredging the river of mud to make it more suitable for commerce, or dredging or draining, you know, fields for monoculture plantation, slavery-based plantation agriculture, or we were talking about draining the city of New Orleans to expand its urban footprint to rid the population of dangerous miasmas. There was this sort of through line of mud that was seen as this sort of fugitive material. And so I use mud as a way in to kind of critique these social relations. And what I kind of found was that the those sort of those social relations continue from you know, plantation capitalism and the exporting of those commodities to market in New Orleans go to the current day. They can be traced to our current moment, where sugar plantations are now the sites of petrochemical plants all along the river, and the oil and gas industry is continues to be this sort of extractive economy that really is consuming the ground beneath people's feet in Louisiana.
And
And yeah, sorry.
no, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Well, so there's a sort of genealogy of extractive logic that is always trying to sort of get rid of this idea of mud. And so what I sort of came to perform as this thought experiment was that, well, muddy thinking would be this way in which we could, you know, clog the wheels of extractive thinking and actually bring some slow thought and think about different ways in which we can, you know, make a living and think about different ways in which we can care and provide stewardship for this area that in a more equitable way, that equitable way that is not just extracting surplus value from the landscape and really sending it to profit centers elsewhere.
Now, one of the issues I'd like to raise with you is this. You've drawn this history that seems very compelling between the contemporary moment and slavery in terms of the treatment of people, the treatment of space, treatment of land, people in all of this. It's what, about 15 years ago, since the terrible oil spill that eventually saw the federal government charge BP and get billions in return for what had been done. Where is public opinion on all of this? Sometimes spectacular events like that make for real change. Sometimes they get washed away and wished away. Only this week I was listening to a public relations podcast that was dedicated to explaining the how they these people helped the head of BP with his dilemma when, as you may recall, he had promised to go yachting with his son and so was not available to discuss the oil spill when it happened, when the explosion occurred. And these people were very proud of the fact that they had helped him to deal with his crisis. Now, apart from obviously these bastards being what Barbara Ehrenreich, I think it was, called the evil twin of journalism, what do you make of public opinion when it comes to this destruction of Louisiana, especially when it's worth mentioning to folks who may not know? This is one of the poorest places in the global north. In indescribable poverty is the everyday experience of the majority of the population. And whilst that is often black in some areas, there are millions of poor white folks as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. And you would think that the BP oil spill would sort of shift public opinion away from, hosting these industries that don't seem to be translating into much sort of wealth for the people that either are affected by them or even or work for them. Many of them, Louisiana. Is very quick to lower any sort of severance tax or industrial property tax on these operators. And when BP actually happened, the public ear and was directed at the Obama administration, most likely because of sort of the conservative political disposition of this area. And when the Obama administration tried to institute a moratorium on drilling for a month to assess other platforms in the Gulf, there was a rally in the Lafayette Cajun Dome with T-shirts saying "Drill, baby, drill," which I believe that was post Sarah Palin, right? So they sort of were inspired by Sarah Palin's call for opening up the ANWR in Alaska. And so, these are people that presumably are affected by the environmental impact of the spill. And but at the same time, they associate their livelihood with this industry. That is sort of destroying the landscape and habitat in which they depend. So it's a very complicated situation in the sense of like it has consumed a future their imagination, right? It's consumed the imaginary beyond, extractive capitalism. We can't sort of the economy the way it is set up. We can't seem to envision a future beyond it. And I would also say that public opinion polls out last year in Louisiana showed that, half the people believe that without the oil and gas industry, the economy would collapse. But, the oil and gas industry employs a fraction of the people that it did 20 years ago. And its sort of centrality to the economy no longer figures. It doesn't match up to its sort of mythical presence, or its, or yeah, the image that it has as Louisiana being this sort of oil and gas state. And so there's a skepticism for renewable energy here. Louisiana ranks 49th in renewable energy consumption. And yet, the Gulf of Mexico would be and would be a excellent place for wind. There is a resistance of solar energy. There's no state incentive programs for solar installation, but there's a huge amount of subsidies for the oil and gas industry. And so it's not a level playing field in any way. And when the BP settlement was issued, it was dedicated to, through various kind of bureaucratic means, it was dedicated councils, it was dedicated to the Coastal Master Plan. So the BP money was dedicated to coastal restoration, which was yet another, which one environmental lawyer called, Mark Davis, called getting a gym membership by winning a pie eating contest. There's a sort of weird paradox. And that money is actually about to run out. So the master plan is underfunded. And when John Barry, the author of Rising Tide, was on the was a really wonderful book about the about social relations of New Orleans and dynamiting the Mississippi River in 1927, the that flooded out all of these poor trappers that didn't get any compensation. He was head of this big drainage district that was reconsolidated after Katrina, and attempted to sue 97 oil and gas and pipeline companies for the damage to the marsh, for the dredging and the drilling, and the state really tried to block the suit, even though these companies were legally required to restore the land back to its current back to its pre developed state. There's no enforcement of that, and the state did everything in their power to block the suit. And his rationale was that there's no funding for the master plan, and if we don't, we can't depend on federal royalties, and we can't depend on this BP money because it's going to run out. So, in 5 years there's basically no revenue. And so those are and so it's what it what that has done is sort of is it really entrapped the powers that be to they're really encaptured by this sort of extractive mindset that they can't see beyond oil and gas. They don't they're not investing in other areas of the economy or other w ways to attract new types of occupation, to improve public schools that would attract families to the state. They can't recruit outside of Louisiana, and so it's really turned Louisiana into this declining kind of state that caters in every way to these extractive industries under the rationale that they would leave were it not for tax breaks and not calling to them to their legal obligations. And so, which is strange because the resources that brought them here are not going anywhere. The Mississippi River is not going anywhere. And so it's a strange argument. Last year they tried to install a legislative bill would have required these petrochemical plants to put in air monitors that cost about 18 grand each. And it was killed because there was an argument that these petrochemical plant operators would leave the state, which is absurd. I mean, they're captured here too by the infrastructure and resources that brought them here in the first place. And so there's really no effort to hold them accountable and leverage the state, what the state's actually the leverage that it has.
This is just
And
one more version, Dr. Ned, of something all too familiar from US history, which is that it's socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. That again and again there is this pattern of monumental public subvention of billionaires. And they might be owners of baseball, so-called football, or hockey teams, or they might be multinational extractive giants. But the last thing they're exposed to is the so-called rigors of the market.
that's
So
right.
you've mentioned bringing together political economy and cultural studies. And often, as you know, there's a debate about how easily that can be done. Because what you've just told us about is essentially a political economic story. And so it's depressing and demoralizing because there are these vast blockages to rationality that are constructed by the state and capital, and that become part of a common sense for working people. But the cultural study side forces us to be more optimistic and utopic, and to recognize that this can be a dialectical process, and there is always resistance and struggle, even if it's demoralizing at times to be involved in it. So I wondered if you could lift my spirits a bit because it's my daughter's birthday and I'm missing her. This is not your responsibility, it's just a request on my part. By telling us a bit about the non-government organization work that you do and work of that kind that's going on, that is trying to fight the good fight here. But please don't feel backed into a position where you have to be Pollyanna-ish.
Yeah. Well, there are some organizations that are in Louisiana, and most of them are really, or all of them are grassroots organizations that were galvanized by one project or another. And they're sort of they and the, and they're affiliated in that there's a movement. Some of them and most of them are people of color who have started it, because these are people on the fence line of these large plants, and they have found success in leveraging historic documents and genealogies and identifying cemeteries of enslaved individuals that bring more scrutiny to development plans. They have filed, claims in court that have brought large projects, multi-billion dollar projects by multinational companies like Formosa, to a halt. And they're really inspirational. There are a couple of there's the Rise St. James, headed by Sharon Lavigne, who just won the Goldman Prize, sort of the environmental version of the Nobel. And these are just regular people who had enough of living in the noise and the shelter in place orders when accidents happen, of seeing their neighbors either diagnosed with cancer or suffer skin or respiratory disease, and that they are really, really galvanizing a fight in a way that we haven't really seen, hadn't really seen in the past, recent past. And you know, and they're getting a lot of coverage and attention. And I think any the more attention that can be sort of brought to these issues in the state and outside the state, the more sort of scrutiny is placed on these multinational corporations that depend on funding and depend on market forces and image to do their business. I mean, it's really easy if nobody's paying attention to come and dump their hazardous waste in Louisiana. But if you're really calling attention to excessive flaring of a of an LNG project, which is the organization that I'm working with, that's one of their focuses. There's a slew of LNG projects, is liquid natural gas projects that are under construction and have been approved from the sort of war footing. It's not a domestic war footing, but the Ukrainian war, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, brought out all of these sort of moribund permit applications that oil and gas companies have been sort of sitting on and waiting for their opportunity. And so that there's a rush to get these LNG projects built. And there's a lot of you know, these are people, these are citizens that are watching flaring, and they're observing things that are happening that shouldn't be happening because of rushed construction and poorly designed operations. And so where the Bucket Brigade works with these folks to match what they are observing, pulling documents from the federal, from the public record, and matching them with you know, reports of emissions that, you know, that exceed their permit application. And so that's an one particular, it's really sort of gumshoe work. You know, it's folks that are, you know, kind of are providing their sort of insight, their sort of on the ground observations to other people, other groups that can, you know, kind of support them and fuss around the sort of bureaucratic space to find documents, and other groups that can sort of use that those documents as evidence to challenge certain permit applications for some of these new projects coming on board, or applications for existing projects to expand. And so the hope is, and you know, of course, President Biden in January paused the sort of approval of certain new LNG permits because of this groundswell of attention. Natural gas was seen as this bridge fuel that was cleaner than coal and going to take us into some new kind of future world. But because of the work of nonprofits basically calling attention to research that, you know, so there's all this methane that's actually escaping, and you know, if 0.2% of methane escapes, it's worse than coal, you know, in terms of greenhouse gas impact. And so that has brought you know, any way you can kind of disrupt the narrative that we're going in the right direction, that these fossil fuel companies are benevolent in some way, and hold the key to being part of the solution to a promise that they to a problem that they, you know, kind of created, I think is a positive move. You know, carbon capture has gotten another is another area where it's gotten a great deal of scrutiny, and there's some private there's some nonprofit organizations here that are really challenging the narrative that carbon capture is somehow going to allow us to continue burning producing fossil fuels. And so what we can do, what I think we have to do, is to support those on the front lines, and then also figure out and pressure policymakers either through, public action or in the court to just slow the march, because these solutions that are favored by the fossil fuel interests are sort of just kicking the can down the road. They're part of the same sort of extractive mentality, and they're not really solving any kind of they're not getting to the root of the problem. They're just allowing for they're operationalizing green discourses of green energy, and even energy the idea that they're positioning themselves as kind of social benefactors, because they're bringing inexpensive energy to new areas of the globe, when in fact all they're doing is capturing subsidies to ensure that their presence will continue, and taking away resources from sustainable alternatives that are available now and could be built out now. And so the every day that we don't aggressively reduce the greenhouse footprint is a day of a missed opportunity, because you don't start saving for retirement at the end of your life. You save for retirement now, and those sort of savings of lack of emissions in this case add up over time. And so we can't be waiting for some new technology. We need to be sort of doing everything we can to bring down bring down emissions, which also has that added benefit of improving local environments and the public health of local communities. And so there's an equitable component to it. There's an in addition to the global scale of the problem, there's local equity involved, and that's a double benefit.
That's a wonderful answer,
Is
Doc,
it?
and credible as well as
I feel
being
like
wonderful.
I'm rambling.
No, not at all. To bring us to a conclusion, I wanted to ask you one question and then invite you to add anything that we've not touched on, or alternatively, add to something that we have mentioned. Does that sound okay as we're
Sure,
finishing?
absolutely.
So, my remaining question is to ask how you went about your research for the book, how you avoided muddy thinking or embraced it.
Yeah, so we were living, we had been in Louisiana when Katrina hit, and we left shortly within the year after 2000 in 2006, for my wife Jessica's residency. And we basically were homesick. We were gone for 12 years, and we really missed being home. I paint a grim picture, but there's a real informal resiliency and cultural persistence and beauty to New Orleans and this area of Louisiana. And in some ways, the precarity has created a real reliance on one another and community. And It's something that we really found its absence was real profound to both of us. And so when it came to graduate study, we were living in San Diego. I chose to pick this. I was always really fascinated by the Mississippi River and its mythology growing up in Louisiana. And I honestly wanted to come home and visit. And so I chose this as my field work to be able to come back. And it wasn't, I guess I was about 5 years into the project. Actually, I was 5 years into the dissertation. So I'd been in graduate school for, I don't know, 7 years by then, that we ended up moving back. But, there was this discourse that, oh, well, to solve Louisiana's coastal problem, all we need to do is release the river into the marshes. But there wasn't really a conversation about the other reasons for oil and gas, oh, excuse me, for coastal erosion, which was, the presence of oil and gas. And ironically, after Katrina, expanding oil and gas became a rationale for rebuilding New Orleans and Louisiana. And so after Katrina, Congress, by the urging of Louisiana officials and by the oil lobby, they kind of came together, this common cause, to open up more drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, dedicate that drilling to the master plan. And so I really felt like there was a larger story to tell about what was happening and how, basically the state was operating with one arm tied behind its back by not going after one of the root causes of land loss, and that was oil and gas extraction. And I started thinking about muddy thinking as a positive thing, that the answers aren't quite as clear as we're led to believe. And it's really sort of getting down and getting in the muck and seeing how people are living together in the, with the very presence of precarity, and how they are finding community, that one sort of finds hope in these kind of spaces. And it's an interesting model, New Orleans, because it in many ways is sort of where a lot of places are heading. New Orleans has taken the brunt in terms of US cities. It's really taken taken it on the chin in terms of climate related disaster. And it is certainly far from perfect, and its governance is certainly far from perfect, but yet it finds joy and common cause, and it sort of offers this model for living in the ruins, that a lot of cities and a lot of places would do well to emulate in terms of community building and culture.
Beautifully put again. I loved New Orleans. I loved living there. And your book made me think of the Michael Flanders and Donald Swann song, Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. And so it goes on, but I'll spare you and other listeners from my eternal variations thereupon. So, Prof, to finish, I wonder if there are things, as I said, that we've not discussed or discussed, but you'd like to elaborate on to conclude.
Well, I feel like I gave you a very sort of muddy response to a lot of questions. One of the things I say in the book that the idea that things are hopeless is really the weapon of the extractive interests, that there's nothing we can do. And in fact, there's plenty we can do now, and the game is not up. It's actually just begun. And we have this obligation to endure, as Rachel Carson said, because it's not just our lifetimes, but it's future lifetimes of future generations. And I'll cite Anna Tsang too, when she talks about the mushroom farming in her book, on the Mutsutake mushrooms, that this is a fungus that grows in ruined places, and there's a wildness all about us. It's not pristine nature, but it's blades of grass poking through the concrete. There is a real persistence to life, and so we really need to do everything we can at every moment to celebrate that and to embrace wildness, because we do have an obligation to endure. And finding these sort of local connections and local ways of worlding and life living is a real sort of in resistance to these sort of larger extractive forces that are convincing us that there's no other way. Well, there is another way, and it's a way that we have to make every day together. So it's a call for community and for togetherness to sort of kind of continue to make our own course and put up resistance and follow and follow and connect with each other.
Ned Randolph, thank you so much for being with us. As always, when I talk to you, I've learned so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.